Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
In this case, it was a four-stage rocket. So the first three stages fell back to Earth, probably burnt up, and the fourth stage went into orbit around Earth after it had released about 12 satellites.
Residents in WA were surprised to find bits of spacecraft had fallen from the sky and become a burning lump in the middle of a Pilbara road. We find out what happened and how vigilant you might need to be in future. So keep listening to The Wire. But first, as grocery prices continue to climb amidst cost of living pressures, the federal government has released draft legislation that would make it illegal for major supermarkets, such as Coles and Woolies, to engage in price gouging, with the ACCC empowered to impose multi-million dollar penalties for breaches. The proposal is now open for public consultation from shoppers to suppliers until November 3. Susan Hu asked Assistant Minister for Productivity, Competition, Charities and Treasury, Dr. Andrew Lee, what was the main issue the reform aims to solve?
Well, our big two supermarkets have two-thirds of the supermarket market. That is a high share by international standards. And the government is concerned that we make sure that they're not price gouging Australian consumers. Other countries have price gouging laws. They operate in Europe and the UK. And we've learned from those examples in setting up the system that will operate in Australia from the beginning of next year.
So is it about bringing grocery prices down immediately or more about building long-term competition in the supermarket sector?
We are all about competition from paddock to pantry, where our reforms in the supermarket sector have ensured that the competition watchdog has more resources to monitor the big supermarkets. And this is about putting a prohibition in place against the supermarkets charging excessive prices. Ideally, we never want this to be used. We want the supermarkets to do the right thing by Australians and therefore ensure that there's no need for the ACCC to bring action. But if there is a need for them to bring action, they'll have strong powers, $10 million fines or up to 10% of turnover.
How will the government actually decide when a supermarket's prices become excessive? For example, what practical tests or benchmarks are there?
Yeah, it'll be up to the courts to determine that. This is a broad prohibition, not one that's sort of narrow or caught up in the circumstances of today, but one that can be effective into the future. The courts will have regard to the cost of supply plus a reasonable profit margin, or they might look at the prices of comparable goods in competitive markets.
Australians are feeling cost of living pressures right now. When could shoppers realistically expect to see a difference at the checkout if these rules take effect?
Well, this will kick in from beginning of next year. And as I said, we hope the laws don't have to be used. We hope that supermarkets will do the right thing in ensuring that they're not pricing excessively on any of their goods. But we do hear stories about shoppers who are concerned that supermarkets are doing the wrong thing. And it's those concerns that have led us to put in place those new powers.
Submissions to the Treasury Consultation Hub are open until November 3rd. Who can take part and what kind of feedback are you hoping for?
We're looking forward to hearing from everyone who's involved. That'll be shoppers, supermarkets and suppliers. We believe that this needs to be a big public conversation because the issue of price gouging has been significant for many Australians. Of course, we're doing a whole range of other things in the competition space. Every new merger in the supermarket sector has to be automatically notified to the Treasurer. We're reviewing the unit pricing code to crack down on shrinkflation. And we're working with states and territories on our national competition policy. The government is passionately committed to a more competitive and dynamic economy, and this is one part of that.
So will these proposed laws also apply to foreign-owned or overseas-based supermarkets operating in Australia?
So these will apply to supermarkets with more than $30 billion of supermarket turnover. At the moment, that covers Coles and Woolworths. Aldi, last time I checked, would have had about $12 billion worth of turnover, so they wouldn't come in for the foreseeable future.
Industry groups argue that these laws add red tape and that most price rises come from global supply costs, not local profiteering. How do you respond to these concerns?
Well, this will be done through the Food and Grocery Code. We're not setting up a new instrument. We're adapting an existing one. We are, of course, concerned to minimise the extent of unnecessary regulation. But in this case, we know that many Australians spend a good chunk of their pay packet on the weekly shop, and ensuring that they're getting a fair deal at the checkout is a big priority for the Labor government.
Dr. Andrew Lee, Assistant Minister for Productivity, Competition, Charities and Treasury, speaking with Susan Hu. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare has proposed new changes to ensure Australian universities are accountable and remain transparent in their decision-making. Universities would be required to report annually on topics such as the outcomes of certain meetings, as well as how they are managing their funds. Clare hopes that these reforms ensure universities maintain trust amongst staff, students and the public. James Bale asked Emeritus Professor Ian Ramsey from the University of Melbourne what were some of the factors behind university cuts which led to these changes being proposed.
One issue is that many universities are under significant financial pressure at the moment, but at the same time, I think there's serious questions to be asked about whether, in fact, some of the universities are cutting in areas where they shouldn't be cutting. Should we be paying senior executives of universities so much at a time when very important courses are being cut and when staff are seeing their numbers reduced also?
Do you reckon there is a sense of underlying corruption within university governance?
I'm not sure that I'd use the word corruption. But what we do know is that there are significant failings of governance across the university sector in Australia. And what do I mean by governance failings? We have seen more than $200 million being found to be underpaid to staff of Australian universities. We've also seen poor student experiences, declining staff morale, poor control of conflicts of interest, excessive use of consultants, allegations of bullying of staff.
You make a strong case for greater transparency across all different aspects. Do you believe there is anything else that government bodies of universities need to do?
Enhanced transparency is going to be important, but there's going to be much more required. For example, what I think would make the greatest difference is an improved culture within universities where views of staff and students are both welcomed and they're also valued by university management. But in addition, transparency and accountability are viewed within the university as matters of real priority. The views of stakeholders, of key stakeholders, and are taken into account in terms of university decision making.
When it comes to the government's new proposed outlines, Minister Clare stated that lots of these new principles aren't mandatory. Is there a reason behind this?
The report of the expert council is important in terms of identifying and documenting serious governance failures. However, they put forward 8 principles, and each of these principles has specific recommendations as part of it. But those principles are voluntary. What the council says is universities should disclose on an annual basis whether or not they comply with these principles. And if they don't comply, they need to explain why. It seems to me that there is a real question why at least some of the principles that the expert council puts forward are not in fact mandatory. Let me give you a couple of examples. Principle 1 has a number of recommendations. It says, for example, universities need to have an effective process for appointing a vice-chancellor. They need to undertake appropriate checks before appointing a vice-chancellor. They need to ensure there's policies that important risks are managed within the university. They need to have policies for ensuring that the regulatory obligations are complied with. The question I pose is, why are these voluntary? Surely any well-run university would in fact have these as part of its core processes. The origin of their principles draws from the Australian Securities Exchange, where the Corporate Governance Council of the Australian Securities Exchange puts forward what's called corporate governance principles and recommendations. There's just a key difference between the 2,000 companies listed on the Australian Securities Exchange. There's a big difference between that range, diverse range of companies on the Australian Security Exchange, and the 39 public Australian universities.
Emeritus Professor Ian Ramsey speaking there with James Bale. Suspected space junk is believed to have crashed in the Pilbara region of Western Australia on Saturday afternoon. The debris was found on fire and lying in the middle of a dirt road. Maeve Groom asked Associate Professor Alice Gorman, space archaeologist at Flinders University, how this space junk was found and what exactly it is.
So it sounds like there were mine workers on their way to work or, you know, coming off shift, something like that. They're driving along a remote road near the Newman mine and they see smoke and they see a big black object lying in the middle of the road. And it's about 1.5 metres in diameter. It seems to be burning, so they know that something is going on. And that was how it was discovered.
Is it common for pieces of a rocket to break off when launched? Assuming this rocket was launched from China, how did it end up in Western Australia?
Well, when rockets are launched, there's a number of points at which things are discarded. So rockets are usually multi-stage. The first stage fuel tanks will drop off before it even leaves Earth orbit. And some of these are now recyclable. They managed to get them to land back on Earth. The second and third stages will drop off before orbit or in orbit. And in this case, it was a four-stage rocket. So the first three stages fell back to Earth, probably burnt up. And the fourth stage went into orbit around Earth after it had released about 12 satellites. So when objects are close to Earth, they're subject to atmospheric drag. The atmosphere heats as the sun goes around the Earth and it expands and the friction pulls objects back in until they fall back to Earth. And most of the time they're completely incinerated because the temperatures are really high. But the really robust material that fuel tanks are made out of, titanium alloy, stainless steel, which are also often insulated with carbon fibres, as this one was, they can land on the ground, more or less intact. This happens a lot, but most of the time people don't see it and they don't always find the rocket bodies or the fuel tanks so soon after they've actually landed, which is what happened in this case.
Would you expect that other pieces of space junk will be found in other parts of the world, perhaps from this rocket launch? Who is legally responsible when space junk lands on another country's territory?
Well, firstly, from this rocket launch, no. This fuel tank that came back is likely the only bit that's actually going to hit Earth, which is kind of good news. But there's an international treaty that governs how all of these things are treated. The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 says that the launching state, China in this case, owns all of its material that it puts into orbit. So it still legally owns this fuel tank. So this means that the Australian Space Agency now has to talk to China and say, kind of, what do you want to happen? If in landing it had caused damage to anything, then China would be liable to pay for that damage. But it doesn't look like it did.
And in regards to this international treaty, is the vast amount of space junk orbiting Earth from, I guess, rockets, satellites being tracked in any way? This one obviously landed in a remote area, but could space debris ever pose a safety risk upon re-entry if not properly monitored?
So there are instruments on Earth, telescopes, observatories that are tracking space junk all the time, but they can't see everything. It has to be above 10 centimetres to be visible to our instruments. And we have lots of gaps. We don't know where everything is. And we don't geographically always know what's passing overhead. So the good news is that lots of people are working on knowing where all the space junk is at any time. But orbits are actually quite unpredictable, so you don't always know where or when something might get pulled back into the Earth's atmosphere. The good news is most of the planet is actually sea or areas of land with low populations. So there is a small risk to cities, towns, populated areas. But so far, it's been pretty rare for any property to be damaged. And the last time a piece of junk hit someone was in 1987. So people shouldn't get too alarmed just yet.
There are concerns that Australia's reach into the Indo-Pacific may be curtailed with the future of the Indo-Pacific broadcasting strategy yet to be renewed by the federal government. the IPBC, funds media programs about Australia's immediate neighbours and has provided the Australian public broadcast with funding for programs focused on Southeast Asia, South Asia and the Pacific. Stephen Hill has this story.
Well, Australia has always had various forms of second-track diplomacy-style media coverage in the Asia-Pacific region, dating back to the 1960s and the creation of Radio Australia. And the job there is really to try to improve the scope of reporting and also, of course, to make Australia look good by the coverage that it has of the Asia-Pacific region. And so this is a fundamental role that the ABC plays. It's not only about Australian-centric news to Australians, it's about a broader Asia-Pacific focus. That is an important part that we need to be thinking more about as the digital technologies change the nature of coverage.
So unfortunately, there still remains a limited coverage of Australia's neighbours when it comes to our media. And similarly, many Southeast Asian countries have limited focus on Australia. How important is it that there be greater awareness between Australia and its neighbours?
So first, in Australia, one of the big problems Australia has is that its coverage of our region is declining. That's because a lot of commercial media organisations simply can't afford to have foreign correspondents, or really much of their coverage is foreign news coverage. And in a world where so much of the foreign news is being dominated by Donald Trump, and then wars in Ukraine and Gaza, over the past seen this rapid decline of coverage of our region. And that is meaning that Australians are increasingly ignorant of what's happening right on our doorstep. So that's in the Australia side of things. And then for why it's important for Asia-Pacific countries to be hearing about Australia, obviously at this current time there's been a reduction in coverage by US-funded free media organisations who are independent journalists. And so Australia could play a larger role there in improving some of the more independent coverage of the region, which it has a long history of.
One thing I would say is that the Indo-Pacific broadcasting strategy in the Pacific has made a really terrific first step. It's really high-quality programs. It's a generational breakthrough in terms of presentation, because the presentation has been by Pacifica people, whether they be people from the region or people from the Australian community. So we've seen a new type of programming, which definitely has built trust, because one of the issues that the Australia-Asia-Pacific Media Initiative was very critical of originally was the fact that when Australia made media initiatives in the region, they were often talking to the region and not with the region. The other element of the project, which is very important, is also the media development side, which is helping Pacific media, because with the current financial constraints and with the digital revolution, media are on the brink of going out of business.
It's a huge web of questions around soft power, around foreign influence operations, around disinformation production, around social media attention economy hacking. None of this is easy, and none of this will be solved, frankly, by even, you know, an extra $20 million. It's not going to solve the broader problem of our information crisis.
So we're seeing China has increased its public broadcasting, has been spending a lot more. Russia has really amped up its information warfare. Are we in a situation where we were having a bit of a media arms race?
Yes, I think you're 100% right. We were seeing, and particularly from China, a lot more efforts, let's put it that way, into engaging with Southeast Asian Pacific media content.
The BBC spent over 800 million Australian on its world service budget, and China is estimated to spend between $5 and $10 billion Australian dollars annually. So 8 million a year. Well, we're asking for it to be doubled, and that's nothing, you know. So you know, what's this billion amount of?
But I would say that this Indo-Pacific broadcasting strategy is absolute bang for the buck when you look at the number of programs that Australia is producing. If you look at the independent evaluation that have been done of earlier parts of the project, you will see that that's been backed up by the research.
Jemima Garrett, OAM, co-convener of the Supporters of Australian Broadcasting in Asia, ending that report by Stephen Hill.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Australia's resources sector is at a tipping point. As global demand for energy transition minerals grows, the pressure is on to innovate, not just faster, but smarter. Thomas Kudis asked Dr. David Miljak, Research Director at the CSIRO, why is collaboration such a critical ingredient for innovation in Australia's resources sector now?
Well, I suppose to make, you know, true innovations in the mining space, it needs a collaboration because you need to bring specialist skills and capabilities for an outcome. So you need the mining companies to make investments in innovation. You need the smaller companies, like they're called the mining equipment technical services sector, to come with ideas where they're very close to the mine face. And then you need the deep sort of research that organisations like CSIRO and universities can bring to make something really different in mining to lift productivity or improve sustainability.
So decarbonisation and digital transformation, from I understand, are reshaping mining. Can you share an example of how these shifts are playing out on the ground now?
Oh, certainly. So there's several different things going on in mining. And one of them is to try and lift productivity. So one way to do that is actually bring a whole new range of smart sensors into the mining space. So things that measure elements and minerals, because mining is actually, it's sort of challenged by having sparse data. So you don't have a lot of data in real time to make decisions. And the data you do have is spatially sort of diffuse as well across the mine. So that's a bit of a trend going on at the moment, to lift productivity and improve decision making by having really smart sensing inside mines. There's other trends around automation. So there's a lot of teams associated with mining trying to make mines safer for humans for a start. So positioning of equipment in mines, having exact knowledge of where equipment's flowing and running. And the ultimate aim of that is actually remove people out of harm's way so that, you know, there's minimal entry of actually humans into these really hazardous situations where, you know, if things go wrong, there can be really catastrophic outcomes for mine safety as well.
CSIRO mentions partnerships like the GMIN and the Critical Minerals R&D Hub. What role do these initiatives play in building a low-emission supply chain for mining?
So these collaborations are actually pretty important. So, for example, GMIN, it's really facing towards at the future of the use of our iron ores. So the Australian iron ores, you know, we're endowed with a beautiful resource of iron ore, but over time, there's a push, obviously, to decarbonise how we extract the iron metal from our iron ores, which are these oxides. And the Australian ores, as it turns out, they're dominated by these hematites, and over time, they might be less amenable for the metal extraction. So there'll be new ways coming through of processing our ores to extract the metal, and our ores have to remain competitive in that process going forward. So GMIN is one of these initiatives where it's bringing collaboration together to see, well, what are the levers, the technological levers we can apply to this problem, the specific Australian problem of how we make our ores adaptable for what's likely to be a very different way of extracting the iron in the future over the next few decades. So that's an important one, GMIN. And in critical minerals, we have what's called the Critical Minerals Hub, and that's an alignment of CSIRO, Geoscience Australia, and ANSTO, the Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation.
Dr. David Miljak, Research Director at the CSIRO, speaking there with Thomas Kutis. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.